go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 6th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, it's great to be with you on this Sunday afternoon as we spend the next hour talking about our nation's space program and everything going on here at the Cape and around the world. And I guess in a show like this, we could mean that literally. Today we're going to continue to talk about what seems like a series of space talk programs we've been having here these past few weeks, discussing the world of commercial space and what it means for our nation and for us here on the Space Coast. We're going to do that today with the help from the president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and its president, former NASA astronaut Michael Lopez Alegria. And if that name's not familiar to you, don't worry, but his should be a household name when you consider all the experience and spaceflight records he has. We'll get to him in just a few minutes. We'd also like to take advantage of your thoughts today on the program. You're certainly invited to join us. Give us a call. Send us an email. As we like to say, no question too dumb and no opinion not worthy of some discussion. Our phone number is 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And our email address is spacetalking@aol.com. In the meantime, let's kick off the program today first by saying congratulations to our United States Air Force and United Launch Alliance team that was responsible for Friday's successful launch of an Atlas V rocket. It was a great sight, as always, to see that nearly 200-foot-tall booster head toward orbit. You should know that the launch was the start of a mission to deploy the second in a constellation of four military communication satellites that are called the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellite. Each one valued at about $1 billion with a B, but certainly worth a heck of a lot more to our national security. The flight, by the way, also marked the 30th launch of the Atlas V rocket since the first one flew, all of them successful. This was also the 60th space shot for the United Launch Alliance team. Friday's launch puts the SpaceX's Falcon 9 next up to bat from Cape Canaveral, and we'll talk about those launch plans as we continue with the program. We're going to move things along now. We're going to offer you today's installment of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Friday's Atlas V launch was clearly the top space news story of the day here on Florida's Space Coast. But another important space-related event happened that may have gotten lost in the noise. Sierra Nevada, not the mountain range or a college or even a brewing company, but one of the new commercial space companies competing with others to launch people into orbit. Well, they announced on Friday that they were committing to base their launch operations on Florida's Space Coast. The company's proposed spacecraft is called Dream Chaser. It is a winged, reusable vehicle that comes from the same lifting body research and design heritage that led to our space shuttle. It's about roughly one-fourth the size of the shuttle. It's designed to launch into orbit atop an Atlas V rocket, then re-enter the atmosphere and glide to a runway touchdown, now at the Kennedy Space Center's shuttle landing facility, which I guess suppose one day soon is going to have to get a new name. Sierra Nevada's very public commitment to the Space Coast is the latest in a series of promising developments that should remind us that, despite the ending of the shuttle program, both the Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station remain open for business. Of course, we should keep in mind that much of Dream Chaser's future success here is contingent on the fact that NASA will ultimately select Sierra Nevada as a provider of launch services to ferry astronauts to and from the International Space Station, all part of the agency's commercial crew development program. This is the program that is part of the nation's new space policy to get NASA out of the business of launching cargo and humans into low Earth orbit and instead purchase launch services from the private industry. As a result, Sierra Nevada's Dream Chaser is competing, for example, with Boeing's Commercial Space Transportation, or CST-100 spacecraft, which also plans a heavy presence on the Space Coast should it get the ultimate contractual nod from NASA. The CST-100 looks much like the Apollo Command Module and NASA's Orion spacecraft. Boeing's capsule would be manufactured, tested, and launched here on the Space Coast, taking advantage and using some of the facilities at Kennedy Space Center that include use of one of the shuttle processing hangars, now no longer needed for the shuttle. Initially launched on an Atlas V, Boeing's spacecraft also would be compatible with the Delta IV and Falcon 9 rockets. The CST-100 is coming along nicely in its development. In fact, just last Wednesday, its parachute landing system was successfully tested for the second time in a month. They dropped a full-size boilerplate vehicle from about 11,000 feet over the Nevada desert, and all went well. And if all of that weren't enough to keep track of, we've got both SpaceX and a company called Blue Origin who are vying for the job to carry NASA astronauts into orbit. And both have received some funding from the space agency. SpaceX has its Dragon spacecraft, which could be launched from the Cape, even the Kennedy Space Center, or even possibly South Texas. And Blue Origin has, well, whatever it is they're going to call their option. They remain fairly tight-lipped about all of their plans. But before we do get to the human-rated stuff, NASA also looking to private industry for cargo delivery services to the space station, of which SpaceX and Orbital Sciences are now contracted to provide. Again, SpaceX with their Dragon spacecraft launch from the Cape, and Orbital Sciences has its Cygnus spacecraft, which would be carried into orbit atop its Antares rocket, which will be launched from the Wallops Island in Virginia. Now, all of this sounds like great news, and I am just as excited as the next space cadet with all the new commercial space activity that is going on. But, of course, big questions still remain. There's a lot of hype, at least here locally, about all the jobs these companies will bring to the Space Coast, but not every company is going to get the NASA contract that makes a lot of this possible. Not every company is going to be able to move in and use the facilities at Kennedy Space Center that were vacated by the space shuttle's retirement. And even with or without NASA money, industry observers wonder if there's enough of a market for these kind of commercial launch services to keep these companies going, and can they make a profit? And there are questions about how well these companies can deal with the technical issues that involve safety and reliability, quality assurance, concerns that have prompted many space veterans to worry that private industry will cut too many corners to save money and won't be successful in the long run. Well, now look, this is a new way of doing things that involves a lot of change. And people are resistant to change, institutions even more so. There's no denying there are technical and financial risks involved here, and there's no doubt there will be serious setbacks of both types along the way. Spaceflight is not a forgiving business. Yet I believe that as a nation, we must be willing to accept that failures will occur and try again, encourage the possibilities that change offers, and embrace the joining of the entrepreneurial spirit with the spirit of exploration. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, when we return, we'll be joined by Michael Lopez Alegria talking more about commercial spaceflight. Don't forget the phone line's open, 768-1240. Send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, as we have mentioned time and again, including today's orbital inclinations, which I just shared with you, our nation's space program is undergoing some fundamental changes in the way that we're doing things. And the major feature of that change is certainly the increased emphasis on commercial space. But I think a lot of us are still trying to sort out exactly what that means. And to help us do some of that sorting today is the president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, Michael Lopez Alegria, who joins us on the phone, I believe, Michael, from the nation's capital. Is that where you're at?
Actually, I'm in Houston today.
Well, you made it down to Houston. How's the weather there? I was going to say, I'll bet it was nicer up north.
It's hot and humid.
Yeah.
What a surprise.
Yeah, 92 and sunny here in Florida. It's been a long time, Michael, since I was a space reporter and you and I were in the same room together, probably at a press conference, but we've watched your exploits over the years. You made 4 trips into space as an astronaut. You've set a bunch of records along the way. You know, you look at your accomplishments and what you've done and your experience with the various folks that you've flown with, and it's clear that you're a perfect person to be heading up this Commercial Spaceflight Federation. We want to talk to you, obviously, about that today. Let's start by sort of trying to define, at least from your perspective as the president of your organization, how do you define what commercial space is in today's industry?
Well, that's obviously an important question to figure out when you're the president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. I think I would bookend it with 2 different thoughts. I think in the purest sense, if we were purely commercial, then it would mean, you know, sort of no involvement from the government whatsoever, at least no developmental funding. Obviously, that is not the case for the orbital flights. The companies that are involved in trying to get folks to the ISS under the Commercial Crew Program. Another way you might define it is that everything is commercial because NASA doesn't build stuff. I mean, it always contracts out to a company, so that's sort of the other extreme. Clearly, where we are today in an industry is a little bit closer to the former than the latter,
yeah.
But it is basically when companies have skin in the game, so financial investment on their part, but at least in the orbital world, the government does remain an important customer.
Well, and if the government is paying as the customer, then it seems to me, whether you're buying computers or services or goods or payroll services, whatever. I mean, if you're buying a trip into orbit, then clearly that makes you commercial. But I guess one of the big concerns is how much oversight does an agency like NASA, how much does it have or should it have in some of these new companies, these new efforts? And does that make a difference then in how you flavor it as commercial versus private versus government?
I think the answer is yes. And that's something that everyone is trying to find that sweet spot. I think too much oversight ends up being too expensive. Not enough oversight arguably means it's a little dangerous. So you need to find that spot that is the right mix of both. NASA does, of course, retain the ability to say yay or nay to anything that they buy. And before they do that, they're going to compare the product to their own specifications. So in that regard, although there may not be insight into the processes or perhaps some of the same type standards that they might have had on the shuttle in terms of materials, let's say, there are some higher-level specifications that NASA can and will impose that the contractors will have to meet.
Well, I guess the industry is familiar with mil-spec. You know, you set a certain specification and either make it or don't. I mean, I guess NASA, if it buys a well, I don't know if it's NASA, but any other agency that wants to buy a computer, for example, from Dell or whatever, isn't going to be on their factory floor looking over their shoulder with quality inspectors. You know, again, you talk about the sweet spot. Is there a culture change that we're going through that we need to go through to better deal with spaceflight on the commercial side?
Yeah, I think there is. You're right about your example with the computer. However, Dell makes a lot of computers. You know, these rockets are not, it's not like they've had hundreds of millions of them come off the assembly line.
Yeah,
so I think it's right for NASA to be, you know, a little bit more involved in that process than they would be on something that's purely off the shelf. But I do think that there has to be a little bit of movement away from at least the levels of insight and oversight that we have been used to in the past.
Well, and as we talk about these definitions, you know, one of the things that I've been kind of interested to watch the reactions from, you know, you've got this concept called new space or new commercial space, and people point to SpaceX and Bigelow and some of those folks as being examples of new space. And then, you know, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and those gang, they look at that and say, well, where do we left out? We still have, you know, we still want to be in this game as well. Yet now they're considered the mainstream old way of doing things, and you know, maybe that's fair, maybe it's not. But could you talk a little bit about this idea of new space versus old space versus whatever we should be calling it?
Yeah, I think that is an accurate perception and an unfortunate one that, you know, there's a divide between new space and old space, or if I could be bold enough to make draw the conclusion to between commercial crew program and let's say SLS/Orion.
Right.
I think that's an unfortunate result of the way the fiscal year 11 budget was rolled out by NASA and by the administration, and I think people involved will be the first to tell you that they could have done a little bit better job of socializing what that was really going to mean. But what happened was people who really believed in constellations saw commercial crew as the enemy. And it was very visceral and very aggressive reaction. And now, unfortunately, we seem to have been divided into these two camps. And one of my goals at the CSF is to try to erase that divide, you know, to have sort of a reformation and realize that both of these programs have to go on in parallel. They're both different pieces of the national space policy.
Yeah.
And they don't have to be enemies of each other. I mean, I understand that the funding in some respects comes from the same pie, but we ought to be fighting to increase the size of the pie, not the size of our slice.
Yeah. And I should have given you a chance right at the start. I jumped kind of quickly into the topic, but tell us about the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and what this organization is about. I know Space Florida is a member of it. I mentioned to one of my family members that you know, that you were going to be on the show and where you're from, and they thought it was going to all be about Star Trek. It's not that federation. Tell us about what your organization is and kind of what your mission is.
Well, it's made up of about 45 companies or so, and I put them into about four broad categories. One category is companies that are vying for contracts under the Commercial Crew Program, like SpaceX, like Blue Origin, like Sierra Nevada Corporation. One group are companies that are trying to do suborbital spaceflight, either for tourism or for research or both. Virgin Galactic, X-Core, Armadillo, Mastin come to mind, as well as Blue Origin. There are several spaceports and sort of infrastructure organizations, Mojave Spaceport, Spaceport America, Cecil Field in Florida.
Yeah.
And then there's a group of suppliers, either engineering services companies or, you know, manufacturers of some kind. So those are kind of the broad strokes that define the federation. And the goal of the federation, not surprisingly, is just to make life better for those companies, either by influencing legislation, i.e. budgets for the Commercial Crew Program, for example, or regulation with the FAA for the suborbital flight. So it's a pretty broad spectrum.
Yeah. You know, and helping these companies out with the FAA is a particular part that I'm interested in, because for a brief time, I worked with SAIC, and that was kind of one of my jobs, was to look into that whole certification process and how do you get a commercial space license and a spaceport operator's license and all of that. Do you have folks coming to you as sort of a open door, an entree to the FAA to figure out how to do all this?
Well, both. I mean, they do. We try to work in unison on certain aspects that are of interest to the industry as a whole. Obviously, when it comes down to getting a license, then each of the operators is going to do that on their own. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, and how do folks become members of that? I looked at the list. You know your top board, I guess. I don't know. You call it a board? Your top advisors anywhere. I mean, they're the cream of the crop. I mean, you got Eric Anderson. You got everybody who's anybody in the quote unquote new commercial space world. It's quite an impressive list.
Right. I think there are about 15 what we call executive members. So 15 of the companies that I mentioned are on the executive side, and they form the board, and then a subset of six of those form the officers of the board, and those are the ones who make more of a tactical and are a little bit more involved in a tactical execution of a plan than the other members. And those companies, as you mentioned, Eric Anderson from SpaceX, Mark Sarangelo from Sierra Nevada Corporation,
yeah.
Gwynne Shotwell from SpaceX.
It seems like it's the top people that need to be watching out for this industry as you go on. Hey, Michael, stand by just for a moment. We do have to pause here. We're going to take our usual five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour, and when we come back, we'll spend some more time with Michael Lopez Alegria. In the meantime, stay tuned for some latest news, weather, and sports. We'll be back with more. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your contributions to the conversation we're having today with Michael Lopez Alegria, former NASA astronaut, now president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation. Phone number 321-768-1240, the email address spacetalking@AOL.com. We did get a call from a listener who watched the Atlas V launch on Friday, was listening to my live coverage on WMMB, and wondered why he saw the rocket lift off before I said the words lift off. And it's one of those kind of behind-the-scenes family secrets, but what's interesting about the radio business these days is that when I speak into the microphone, it's got to go through a computer and be processed and then sent to the transmitter and then out into the air. And that all that processing time actually takes several seconds. So when I'm saying what I'm saying right now, you're hearing it about 4 or 5 seconds after I actually said it, even though you think it's perfectly live. And it's just kind of the way it works. And so one of the kind of the tough things about watching rocket launches is that if you can actually see the launch off the pad and you're listening to the live radio, even TV is the same way. You're seeing things and hearing things just a few seconds after they actually happen. Or you're seeing them actually, we're seeing them at the same time. Boy, this is like time paradox. We're seeing them at the same time, but by the time you hear it, a little bit of time has passed. And so it's one of those things that we try to deal with. And, of course, you can't say it lifts off before you see it lift off. That wouldn't be good either. So anyway, that's the story about that. It was a busy weekend with that Atlas V launch on Friday. I do want to note the fact that that we also this weekend celebrated the induction of three new members into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. We had a big dinner Friday night and then the ceremony Saturday at the Visitor Complex. This year's class was made up of Franklin Chang Diaz, Kevin Chilton, Charlie Precourt, and I don't really have time to run down the incredible accomplishments of each man, so let me say this. I am honored to be a member of the selection committee and proud to say that this year my top three picks all wound up being selected, so congratulations to Franklin and Chili and Charlie. And now returning with me on the phone from Houston, a former NASA astronaut who I'm sure in another 5 years or so, since he's retired now this year from NASA, we'll be sitting on that induction ceremony stage. Michael Lopez Alegria has the record for number of spacewalks at 10, the longest single mission in space of 215 days. I've never actually said this. This is future Hall of Famer Michael Lopez Alegria. Michael, welcome back to the show. Good to have you still with us.
That's pretty high company that you're mentioning there, so it would be more than an honor to join them.
Please. Oh, you know, we talk about these in the NFL, all these future Hall of Famers, and that's something that in the space media we just don't normally say about former astronauts. I think I'm going to start a new trend, and from now on call you future Hall of Famer. Anyway, let's talk. Let's wear the astronaut hat real quickly here. Take advantage of that. The three guys you mentioned, high company. I know you didn't actually wind up flying with them, if I've checked my records correctly, but I know you worked with them closely. Any particular stories to tell about any of them?
probably none that they'd want me to repeat on the air.
Yeah, and they were doing the same thing at the induction ceremony yesterday. So the one we weren't sure we should say this or not.
Yeah, no, great. I mean, you probably didn't have a very difficult job this time to pick those three. They really stand out, guys. And obviously, General Chilton went back to the Air Force as an 06. And, you know, I think he put on about a star a year for a while there.
Yeah, four stars when he retired. My gosh. So, well, yeah, hey, you
Charlie
know.
Was, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things that I've always wanted to spend some serious time talking about is trying to understand, you know, from your perspective as an astronaut who was launched on both the space shuttle and the Soyuz, and going up and coming back, you know, can you just real briefly tell us what, quote-unquote, that's like to be riding in the Soyuz and going up and back?
Sure. You know, the physics are about the same. They both take about 8.5 minutes to get to orbit. You go from zero to about 25,000 feet per second, 17,500 or so miles an hour in that time. Acceleration profile is not terribly different. They both are three-stage. Well, it's not really true. I guess the shuttle is considered a two-stage vehicle. But,
right.
The difference going uphill, first of all, the biggest difference is just the size. I mean, the Soyuz is really tight. It's very cramped. I'm about as big as I'd ever want to be to get in one of those things.
Your knees are right up in your face.
Yes, you're sort of in a kind of a fetal position, shoulder to shoulder with your two crewmates, and it's pretty tight. The ride uphill is a little bit smoother in the Soyuz because the solid rocket boosters have a lot more vibration to them.
Yeah.
From the time they come off at about 2 minutes through MECO, it's pretty similar. They're both very smooth. I would say I noticed a little bit more kind of very low-level oscillation in the Soyuz, but it was small. It was basically just a very strong push in the back the whole time as you're accelerating. Staging is a little bit more dynamic in the Soyuz because the particularly between second and third stage, when the second stage engine stops and then the third stage engine lights, there's sort of a brief, slamming on the brakes and then getting on the gas again.
Yeah.
But the biggest difference is entry. Entry in the shuttle is really gentlemanly. It's very smooth, maybe a G and a half. Feels a little bit more than that because usually, you know, a little bit deconditioned, but mm-hmm. It's very graceful, touchdown. It's just like a commercial airliner. In fact, sometimes even softer.
Mm.
On the Soyuz, on the other hand, it's I think I described it as a bunch of explosions followed by a car crash. I mean, it's really pretty dynamic. You know, the entry, it feels rough. The G levels are a lot higher.
Yeah.
It's about a little over four nominally for about a minute or so. And then when the parachute sequence starts, there's just a lot of stuff going on, a lot of dynamics. And then there's so-called soft landing jets that fire right before you hit the ground. And so you generally hit the ground pretty hard on your back and often then kind of falls over on its side. So it feels like you got rear-ended and then T-boned. So it's pretty dynamic.
Yeah, I would say. When you landed in the Soyuz, did you land in a way that the guys could come and get you, or did you have to crawl out the top like I've heard some others have to do?
No, the SAR guys had us in sight all the way down.
Did
so
they, really?
They were right there. And they basically roll the capsule manually until they get it in the right orientation and then kind of drag us out.
Now, when you have you had a chance in your career after the Soyuz flight to compare notes with any of the, well, I guess the Apollo or Gemini guys, the old guys that that flew the capsules and screamed in back from the moon? You know, it's the nostalgic. I got a chance to cover Norm Thagard's launch on the Soyuz in Moscow, and I couldn't help but think that this was like the quote unquote old days of our, you know, our Apollo and our Titan IIs and our Atlases. Have you ever had a chance to compare notes with those guys and kind of think about what it might have been like to be one of the early guys flying on a capsule like that?
Well, you know, I never thought about doing that. I mean, first those guys are all gone from the office, but I do interact quite a bit with General Tom Stafford, who obviously has Gemini and Apollo experience. And I never thought to ask him what that was like. You know, you have to think that at least from a G profile and such, the entry is going to be pretty similar, right?
Oh, yeah. And I think that we're famously heard the G forces on the Mercury guys were pretty steep. A whole different dynamic, but in any case, let's get back to commercial space. But related to that Soyuz flight, you had, and boy, I've practiced saying her name, Anousheh Ansari.
Anousheh Ansari.
I guess she was the third Space Adventures paying passenger to the International Space Station, first female. But truly, as I've learned from her in the years since, she's got that entrepreneurial spirit. We talked about in my orbital inclinations, combining the spirit of exploration and the entrepreneurial spirit. Did you catch any of that? Does that have any flavor? Is that any influence on you whatsoever as you went into this Commercial Spaceflight Federation gig and think about what's possible?
Quite a bit, actually. You know, I have to confess that I was kind of a non-believer back in the day about space tourism. I thought the ISS is not an appropriate destination for non-professionals, and I didn't have much of a say in who was going to fly with us. We just trained, and at that time, the paradigm was the third seat was often free, and the Russians would sell us the Space Adventures, and they in turn would find somebody who would pay the kind of money that they were asking to be able to do it. And but I'll tell you, I really changed my opinion after being up there with her for about 8 days or so and watching how she interacted with people on the ground through her blog and through the interviews that she did. And what struck me was it was bringing in a whole group of people that normally don't pay attention to space, that all of a sudden were interested, engaged, and fascinated by what she was doing. And she's such a good ambassador. You know, she's very soft-spoken and just seems like such a nice person. It was very endearing to a lot of people. And that kind of sold me on the merits of space tourism. Now, I'm still not too sure about what I think about folks going to the ISS, but I can tell you that the two that I flew with, so Anousheh flew up with me, and then I flew home with another gentleman named Charles Simon.
Yeah.
They were both great up there. I mean, they're not disrespectful. They know what their limitations are, and they're very, willing to help you. They don't do anything they're not supposed to do. And like I said, there's a big plus from all the interest that they can generate.
Well, space tourism, of course, and as we talk more about it here on the Space Coast, I've seen some of the same reaction from guys that I really admire and respect here locally that just are saying, the space tour, it's not going to happen. It's a fad. It can't be real. It just doesn't make any sense. And I want to get your take on that. Unfortunately, we've already chatted too much, and we're coming up on our final break of the day. So, Michael, if you just stand by, we're going to take that break. And then when we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation, talk about some space tourism, give you the next launch forecast as well, and see what else is on everybody's minds as we sign off here toward the end of the hour. We'll be back in just a little bit. I'm Jim Banky, and this is, as always, Space Talk on a Sunday afternoon right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
And welcome back as we begin today's final segment of our edition of Space Talk. A quick reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just look us up at Space Talk. And if you're on Twitter, follow the Space Talking as our little hashtag there, whatever. And for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com. Use keyword Space Talk. You get our show page, and all the links are right there. As we do continue along, let's do take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. As we have already talked about today, the next launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station is the Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX, now targeted to fly no earlier than May 19th at about 4:55 in the morning Eastern Time. The launch was delayed another week or so to give the company some more time to make sure everything is ready to safely fly, and that's certainly what we all want. Looking much farther ahead, just for long-range planning, in case you're interested, the next Atlas V launch from the Cape is now targeted for June 18th, and the next Delta IV launch is aiming for June 28th. And that mission, by the way, will feature the use of a Delta Heavy rocket, which for me remains the most impressive-looking launcher flying today and still scares the heck out of me. Of course, we'll tell you more about those missions as we get closer. And for more information about all of the various launches scheduled around the world, go ahead, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. We've been talking today with Michael Lopez-Alegría, former NASA astronaut, current president of the Commercial Space Flight Federation. He's talking to us on phone from Houston. Michael, we were talking about space tourism. It seems like space tourism is always just around the corner. It's just about to happen. Virgin Galactic needs just a little bit longer to get ready. Is this thing going to happen? And what do you think is going to be the reaction to the public? Is this thing going to take off like, you know, cookies, hot biscuits, whatever the right cliche is?
Well, first of all, I absolutely think it's going to happen. You're right. It's been a little frustrating, but, you know, this is difficult stuff. And like you said before, we want to get it right. So I think it's wise, particularly in a commercial tourist environment, to make sure that you've got all the T's crossed and I's dotted before you launch for the first time. It'll be interesting to see what the reaction is. I mean, I think, but judging on the demand already that Virgin has, for example, with over 500 people already signed up, basically on speculation and investing anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000 to do it, I imagine it's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, and we talk about getting it right. We want that space tourism to happen safely, of course. But we're also paying a lot of attention now, of course, locally here to the Falcon 9 launch later on here this month. There's been a tremendous amount of hype, a tremendous amount of interest from the mainstream media, a tremendous amount of analysis and focus and under the magnifying glass for these folks, for Elon Musk and the whole team. Tell us from your perspective just how big of a deal is this launch, carrying the first private commercial cargo carrier possibly to the International Space Station to berth with it if all goes well. How big of a deal is this thing?
Well, it's obviously important. I mean, like a lot of folks, we're trying to reduce expectations because it is a very difficult endeavor. You probably know that this is a combination of two different launches or test flights that they combined into one. So not only they're trying to get a good liftoff and orbital insertion, but trying to then do a rendezvous, first to fly under, check out some sensors and parameters, and then an actual rendezvous ultimately leading to a berthing where the crew will use the space station's robotic arm to grapple Dragon and attach it. So if everything goes right, I'm not saying it's a miracle, but it'll be extremely positive sign. I think more likely is there will probably be some things that don't go perfectly, and I think what's important is for people not to get discouraged or try to pin all the hopes on commercial spaceflight on this particular launch.
Yeah, that to me is the key thing about pinning the whole industry on one launch. It is a test flight after all. You've sat in there, you've floated in there, and the space station is commander. You've watched Soyuz come up, you've watched Progress vehicles come up and dock. You know, how I don't know if nervous is the right word, anxious, interested will this crew be in watching what's going on? And I know they're cheering them on, but what are the big concerns as this thing is about to happen?
Yeah, I'd say probably all of the above. This vehicle will approach quite a bit slower than Soyuz or Progress does, a little bit more like an HTV, if you've seen what that looks like. It's
sure,
quite a bit slower. Of course, the crew will be monitoring. They have the ability to wave off the capsule if they don't like what they see. They have overlays on the projectors on the screens of the cameras so that they kind of know what it should look like as it comes down the corridor in terms of being off axis. And so, yeah, I'm sure they're rooting for it. I mean, I can't imagine that they'd be want to do anything except grab that thing and attach it. So.
Especially if there's some fresh fruit or a nice wheel of cheese on board, as there's rumored to be. but for all the time, rendezvous and docking, been doing it for years, going back to Gemini 6, 7, Gemini 8, and all this experience at the space station, I just think that it's a lot harder to do, even with all the experience. This is going to be a lot tougher task than the average person even understands it to be. And I know you're going to agree with me, but you know, is there one piece of it that's harder than the other? Is it the guidance? Is it, you know, what is it? If you could, real quick here, we got to wrap up here.
Well, let me just say that we have not, as a country, have not demonstrated the ability to do this in an automated way yet. All of the rendezvous that we've done on Gemini, on Apollo, and on Shuttle are manual. And so with a pilot in the loop, the task is, you know, a lot of it depends on the pilot. But in this case, there is no pilot in the loop. It's all automated. So that is a big difference in my mind.
Well, and so let me we just got about another 30 seconds. So tell me real quick about the importance of Space Florida and organizations like that to help make some of the commercial space stuff happen, not only here but in other markets across the country. Talk about that local part of it real quick.
Well, you know, ultimately NASA funding, at least, is voted on by Congress, who was elected by constituents, and so it is the grassroots organizations that excite their local population to get behind something. And I think Space Florida has realized that a big part of their future is going to be in the commercial world, and that message needs to be spread not just to Florida but to other places that have spaceports and companies that are doing that kind of business.
That's great. Michael, we're running out of time with you. Thank you so much for being on the program today. We'll continue to monitor what you're doing. We offer our support, anything we can do to help you and your organization get the word out. You got my email address. Just let me know what we can do for you, okay?
Thank you, Jim, and best of luck to all of you on the Space Coast.
Thanks, Michael. Take care now, okay? All right, well, there goes Michael Lopez Alegría. Next week on Space Talk, my guest is going to be Garrett Skrobot, the New Star mission manager from the Kennedy Space Center. New Star, a small science payload that will be sent into space in June on a Pegasus rocket launched from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific. We're going to talk about the mission and try to learn how the KSC launch team is going to launch something from the Pacific, and I'll give you a hint. It involves a lot of travel. In the meantime, stay in touch with us at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and you'll be able to get everything you need to know about what we're going on there. That is all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Sunday, 3 p.m., same space time, same space channel. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of The Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.